What is the truth behind the development and research of this vaccine, the trials with animals and then humans, the regulatory corners that were cut? How does it work? Now, with us today to discuss this and more, the development of mRNA technology, how it applies to the vaccines, the concerns about the spike protein, the efficacy of the experimental vaccines, as well as the growing concerns, is none other than Dr. Robert Malone. He's an internationally recognized scientist with specialties in virology, immunology, molecular biology. He was trained in medicine at Northwest University and Harvard University, in pathology at UC Davis. He's really cited in many, many publications all across the medical academic literature. But most importantly, he is the inventor of mRNA vaccines. While at Salk Institute in 1988, he was very instrumental in patenting that technology. So when I saw Dr. Malone on Tucker, and then he was on with my colleague Glenn Beck, I was thinking to myself, wow, what better person to bring on to explain how this works than Dr. Malone? Doctor, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me and for the opportunity to share information and knowledge with your listenership.
And those venues of dissemination are really narrowing in terms of your options. Obviously, you were knocked off of LinkedIn because you're not allowed to talk about this, which is really where I wanted to start. You know, people like myself, I'm a political guy, a kind of a legal guy, policy guy. I know nothing about science and medicine. And like anyone else, you know, I would never think they would develop something marketed as a vaccine that would have such problems. So I could understand if they start saying, you can't talk about it, you can't talk about it. To me, there must be something they're hiding. So I wanted to start with just the raw basics of how this works relative to traditional vaccines. I see the other side, they deny it up and down. They say it's just a backhanded way of working like a vaccine, like anything else. I'm just going to read to you Moderna's SEC filing and get your comment on this. They say, currently mRNA is considered a gene therapy product by the FDA. Unlike certain gene therapies that irreversibly alter cell DNA and could act as a source of side effects, mRNA-based medicines are designed to not irreversibly change cell DNA. However, side effects observed in gene therapy could negatively impact the perception of mRNA medicines, despite the differences in mechanisms. So they swear up and down, don't confuse this with gene therapy. What say you, Dr. Malone?
No, they don't say that. They say that they acknowledge that it is a gene therapy, but that it's slightly different. That is a fascinating quote you just gave me, because you'll notice that it predates the focus on the vaccines. So Moderna was originally a mRNA as a drug, or an mRNA for therapy purposes. And that SEC statement says nothing about the vaccine applications. And it explicitly says that the FDA considers this to be a gene therapy. Now, what's fascinating about that, and this gets to the core of why things have gone so sideways, is that the FDA, when it received the dossier for these things as vaccines, they elected to not apply the checklist. I'm afraid this is how things are at the FDA. There isn't a whole lot of thinking a lot of times. There's checklists, okay? So they have these checklists, and they applied the vaccines checklist, not the gene therapy checklist. And that's where a lot of this went sideways. So do you want to talk just really quickly about what is an RNA vaccine?
What it is, and also if you could just explain the history a little bit, what you are developing, what it was designed for, and why possibly it's not working or problematic in the context of the COVID vaccines.
So let's start with what is it? And I've been working on how do you simplify this, not to talk down to people, but there's a quote from Richard Feynman that if you can't make a complex idea simple, you don't really understand it. So I kind of took that as a challenge. Let's imagine that we're talking about computers. We're talking about computers as an analog for what happens in your cells and your body. Okay, so if we take the computer as the metaphor, the hard drive is your chromosomes, your DNA. the programs that are coded into your hard drive is the sequences, the coding sequences, the information in that DNA. So DNA is a hard drive. Programs are the coding in your DNA. The things that make, imagine this, the things that make proteins in your cells, imagine those as little industrial robots that can make anything. mRNA is the thing, the message, the information, the bit streams that goes from your programs on your hard drives out to those little robots and tells them what to make. mRNA vaccines are a way, they're like a hacker that opens up channels and inserts his own information into that bitstream so that those little robots in your cells, instead of making whatever it was they were going to make, start making vaccine protein. Does that make sense?
That actually sounds perfectly. So rather than dangling in front of you an inert viral cell that the body on its own naturally responds to, here you put an mRNA, a message to say, hey, here's what we want you to do, produce that spike protein. Did I explain it okay?
You're dead on. Okay, so a traditional vaccine is usually an inactivated pathogen. Sometimes it's a weakened pathogen like yellow fever. And you inject that and your body responds to it. So these are mRNA vaccines, and by the way, recombinant adenovirus vaccines are both gene therapy technology applied to vaccinology. Now you want to jump into the history a little bit and I'll illustrate that.
Yes, absolutely. So when is it appropriate and when is it not?
Oh, well, that's a different question. When is it appropriate? So the thing about applying gene therapy technology, which means to say that we have foreign genetic material and we're using technologies that put that into your cells and turn your cells into little manufacturing factories that are making vaccine. That's the essence of it, okay? And instead of manufacturing the actual vaccine outside of the body, putting it in a syringe together with what we call an adjuvant, something that stimulates your immune system, and shooting it into your deltoid, into your shoulder, what we're doing is we're shooting in the information that will change some of your cells into little vaccine manufacturing factories. When is it appropriate? Why do this, right? Number one, it makes the process of developing a vaccine, the material, the composition of matter, dead easy, because the RNA chemically is within, you know, generalities, it's pretty much all the same. It's just a bunch of A's and U's and G's and C's strung together in a sequence, and they're basically negatively charged. So the technology necessary to stuff that into a FedEx envelope, the nature of the FedEx envelope that delivers that into cells is pretty much the same. It doesn't matter. The manufacturing technology for making the RNA is pretty much the same. The difference is that you sit down at your computer and you say, this time I want it to have this sequence for a flu protein, and that time I want it to have the sequence for a SARS-CoV-2 protein. But chemically, it's really similar. And so the manufacturing becomes a lot more straightforward. As opposed to regular vaccines, everything is custom. So it makes it easy, makes it go fast. The other thing about using gene therapy kind of technology is that when the cell expresses the proteins to your immune system, it looks a lot more like you're actually infected by the virus, for example. And the implication of that, because you're actually producing a virus protein, not the whole virus, it's not infectious. You're producing a part of the virus that would normally stimulate an immune response against it. But viruses also produce a lot of other things that shut down the ability of your immune system to recognize those things. So you can produce the protein in your little factories without all the extra fancy stuff that the virus uses to keep your immune system from recognizing it. What does that give you? there's two main arms of what we call the adaptive immune system as opposed to the innate immune system. And this is where I get crossed up with people that are using the terminology natural immunity. But what they mean with natural immunity is, you know, most people are talking about it now, is the immunity you get from actually getting infected by SARS-CoV-2. So let's park that. I'm not talking about that kind of natural immunity. Innate immunity is this more ancient immune system that we all have that goes way back to our lizard brains. And it has ability to recognize some general patterns that are shared by many different kind of pathogens and fight those things off. Then there's the adaptive immune system. This is the more modern part of our immune system. And it's able to actually learn from the shape and structure and composition of proteins and other antigens that are produced by a pathogen, whether it's a bug, a bacteria, I mean, or a virus.
So those are like the T cells.
So the T cells, you said the key word, that's the cellular immune response. And it's really complicated. One of the, what we call effector T cells, the business part of T cell response, are cytotoxic T cells that cruise around and they can kill cells that either have cancer mutations or have are manufacturing virus instead of manufacturing vaccines. So those are the killer T cells. And the other part are the B cells that make antibodies. So antibodies is called humoral or blood-borne. The nomenclature doesn't make any sense anymore. It's because of, you know, historic immunology, how it developed. But you get antibody responses basically and cytotoxic T lymphocyte responses. It's the, you know, top level idea. And so the antibodies can neutralize the virus and do stuff when it's outside of the cell. And I'm simplifying grossly. And the cytotoxic T lymphocytes can kill cells that are infected with virus. You want both of those. And it's a lot easier to get both of those with this kind of gene therapy approach than it is with the more traditional vaccines. So there, that's a pretty deep dive.
And that's how it works. That's why you'd want to use it. Now, when has it been used before? And why are the COVID vaccines' use of the mRNA different and more concerning?
The real problem is, and everybody's focusing on the mRNA vaccines and their problems, but in fact, it's the genetic vaccines that are expressing spike. The problem is the protein. It's the payload. It's not the technology. People are focusing on the technology because it seems so foreign and spooky. But these recombinant viruses, DNA viruses called adenoviruses, they're kind of cold virus. Make your lymph nodes swell, that's what I call adeno. They've been engineered, and that technology's been used for years and years and years, and there are already licensed vaccines that use recombinant adenoviruses. That you take out some of the DNA of the adenovirus and you put in a DNA copy of the virus, the protein that you want to express, like say spike. And then you button all that up, make little adenovirus particles that don't actually replicate except in cell culture, and inject that into a patient. We call that the J&J vaccine or the Sanofi, Oxford, AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe. And they're really the same tech, but with a different platform. The thing about the adenovirus vector, so here we would call it J&J, is that that platform is made so that it expresses lots of protein for a long period of time. The RNA vaccine platform is designed so that you put the RNA in, it causes your cells to make the vaccine protein for a while, and then the RNA gets cut up. Okay, so it's a shorter term, we call it transient gene therapy or transient RNA therapy, which is what Moderna was talking about, is using RNA as a therapeutic in their prospectus that you just read. So RNA gets cut up, doesn't stick around so long, so you get a burst of protein expression, then it's gone. The adenovirus, you produce protein over a longer period of time. Now, the thing is that they're essentially all three vaccines that we have are using the same approach, and they're expressing the same protein. That's not the only protein antigen that could be used, but it was kind of like the low-hanging fruit, if you forgive the metaphor, the easy thing to do, the kind of no duh, for sure this is going to work, and we don't have to worry about that part, and we can get on with our business. The problem is that the whole the spike protein itself, and I've been fact-checked by our friends at Reuters who say that this is not true, but in fact, it is true. I'm going to watch my words. The native spike protein in the virus is clearly demonstrated in multiple peer-reviewed publications to cause coagulation problems, cytotoxicity, and open blood-brain barrier. Okay, that means that things can get into your brain and out of your brain that normally would.
So you're saying the spike protein produced by these platforms, they break that blood-brain barrier. They could permeate that.
No, you missed the nuance of what I said. Okay, the native spike protein as produced in the virus does that.
Ah, got it.
Now, whether or not the spike protein that has been engineered, for instance, to be locked into the open conformation that allows it to efficiently bind ACE2, this key regulatory protein that it's its natural receptor, okay, that's what's being expressed in most of these vaccines, so it's a little different. And some claim that it is not toxic, even though the native spike from which it's derived is toxic. Here's my problem with that. I haven't ever read that paper. I haven't ever seen data demonstrating that. Right now, it's just self-appointed experts yapping on Twitter. I haven't seen those data showing that that's safe. And the thing is, apparently the FDA has not forced the developers to demonstrate it. And you know, from a legal perspective, the way things work with drug development is like the French judicial system. You're guilty until proven innocent. The starting assumption is that you're toxic. And it's the job, the requirement that the developer has to demonstrate using cell culture experiments, animal experiments, anyhow, all that, before they ever get into humans, they have to demonstrate that it's safe. Not that we have to prove that it's not safe. So what we know is that spike is toxic, and you can take that to the bank, and I can cite multiple manuscripts to that end.
So we know the spike in the native virus obviously is toxic. Their idea was, hey, well, we produce that, but it won't, you know, create the virus, so it will kind of work like a vaccine. It will work great, but now we're seeing these side effects. Even if the absolute risk, and we still don't know, is low.
And here's the tell in all this, okay? And the government, in its wisdom, you know, and the governments worldwide are dug in denying that this problem exists. And there's reasons why they're dug in.
So one of the ways they were dug in is they were saying that the spike protein, it stays in the shoulder muscle, and now we know it goes elsewhere. Could you describe the circulation, where it goes, for how long, and what possible concerns grow out of that circulation of the spike protein?
So there's – in this – people are getting confused because there's this – FOIA'd, and I don't know if your audience understands, so Freedom of Information Act was used by some Canadian scientists to obtain the regulatory documents that Pfizer submitted to the Japanese government. Normally, you can't FOIA these things out of the U.S. government or the Canadian government. For some reason, Japan, they were able to spring it loose. And those showed the preclinical or non-clinical animal studies that Pfizer did looking at what's called the distribution of injected RNA with the formulation and the package part of the FedEx box, that's the lipids, and where the RNA makes protein. So people get confused. There's that package of information. And then there's the information about that, as you just pointed out, the party line was, and this was published, that if you inject it into the muscle, it stays put, more or less, or it goes to the draining lymph nodes. And then along comes this study from Harvard and Brigham Women's and Children's. It wasn't intended to show this, but what they did was they had a super sensitive way to look for spike protein subunit in the blood. And what they found in this study of nurses that received Moderna, and then it was monitored over time, it showed that there was significant levels of free spike protein subunit in their blood. that wasn't supposed to happen. And it lasted for, 2 weeks to a month. And it was reasonably high levels detected in most of these nurses for this period. There's a distribution curve of how much protein and how many nurses. So it's in the blood, which means it's circulating all over the place. And it's also, that's just measuring the tip of the iceberg, because that means there's spike protein back in the factory cells that's still bound. Hopefully that's most of it. And then there's spike protein that's been free, but it's stuck to other stuff. What other stuff? We don't know. No one's measured it. But if it's binding to ACE2 with any kind of affinity, it could, which means stickiness, it could well be that what they're measuring with free spike in the blood is just a tiny fraction, because there's a bunch of it that's binding to other things in your body or is stuck to those cells that's producing it. So it's probably a significant underestimate of the total amount of protein. Does that make sense?
No, that definitely does. But the question is, for how long? We're seeing most of the side effects, 10, 30 days or so. Are there concerns?
And there's a paper that should be hitting the street soon, I've heard rumor of, that shows that where some of this spike ends up is inside of a cell type called a macrophage. So these are mobile cells that move around. You may have seen something like this in some of the microbes when you looked under a microscope when you were in eighth grade or whatever. So these are cells that move around in your body, and they control the whole inflammatory process. They also gobble up debris and things like that. And it looks in this paper that one of the places this spike is going is it's getting stuck inside of these cells, and it's flipping them on in a weird way, so that they're basically throwing out all kinds of things that turn up inflammation, that turn up the dial on inflammation. We call them pro-inflammatory cytokines and chemokines. So these migratory cells are apparently sucking up spike, and spike is changing how they behave. And this may explain both long COVID and a lot of these symptoms. So that's part of what seems to be going on, but there's more than that. And we first saw it with the adenovirus. That's why I tried to make the point that the AdTech and the mRNA tech are kissing cousins, except for the adenovirus makes a lot more protein for a longer period of time. And what happened with the adenovirus vectors? Oh, they had really big problems with blood clots. Okay. They're making more protein, longer period of time. We picked it up really early. They caused blood clots. You may remember there was a hold, and then there was a kind of a hand-waving decision that, well, we're going to pull the hold because we need these vaccines and we think the risk-benefit ratio is good. But in a lot of countries, they won't touch them because they think they kill people. So now you ask the question, how much and for how long? Brilliant question. Very straightforward. FDA didn't ask it.
Wow.
They didn't ask the developers to characterize the level, duration, and rigorously characterize the distribution of where those proteins are being made. They did non-good laboratory practice. So that's like what a graduate student does on the bench, for his PhD or whatever. Not well controlled. Non-GLP studies in a limited number of animals to look at where the protein goes. They didn't actually use the what we would call the active drug substance, RNA that codes for spike. They used RNA that codes for a reporter gene, something that's easy to detect. And it just so happens the name of this reporter gene is luciferase. It has nothing to do with the devil. It's the protein that makes the firefly tails glow. And it turns out that you can use this sequence to make that protein, and then you add a chemical and it makes light. And light is really easy to detect with what we call photomultiplier tubes. This is why we have satellites that can look at your license plate on your car. Okay, so really sensitive PMTs that can detect light. And it's a brilliant example of Pfizer pulling the wool over the regulators. Pfizer used the least sensitive way to detect that expression. They looked at whole animals. So in that case, the light has to come from wherever the protein is being expressed, go through the muscle, go through the skin, go through the fat, go through the fur, and then hit the photomultiplier tube. And so what that means is that most of those photons get bounced somewhere else. And the only thing you see are the areas that are expressing really high levels of protein. And lo and behold, they conclude, oh, it mostly stays at the site of the injection plus some in the liver. Okay. That any of us that do this for a living look at that and we laugh. That's like a parlor trick that we use to put on the cover of a manuscript of a journal or something like that. The way to really do this, then, you know, goes back to, I'm sorry to say, it goes back to my pioneering studies. I was one of the first ones to use luciferase for all this stuff, is what you really ought to do. Close your ears for vegetarians and animal rights folks. You sacrifice the animal and you carefully dissect out all the tissues and organs. You put each of those in tubes. You add some buffer, you lyse the cells, you pop the cells open, take a little sample, put it in a machine. It counts exactly how much light is given off. And that tells you precisely how much of that transgene protein, the luciferase protein, has been made from, say, the RNA that might have reached that organ. That's the way you do it. Okay, but Pfizer didn't do that. They did the least sensitive method. And for some reason, the FDA and all the other world regulators said, well, that's good enough. That proves the point.
Wait a minute.
What it shows is that the people that are overseeing this haven't got a bloody clue what they're doing. And the reason is because they had the vaccine guys and gals look at it, not the gene therapy guys and gals, because they decided in their wisdom that these are just like any other vaccine, and they clearly aren't. That's why I say what they should have done, and this is typical in the FDA, when you have a novel product, they'll bring in people with different expertise to review it, not just one team. And what they did in this situation is they only had the traditional vaccine team, and they used the traditional vaccine checklist. And they said, well, you never do reproductive toxicology on vaccines, and you never do genotoxicity on vaccines. And you never have to characterize duration of expression in vaccines or levels of expression, because they're just vaccines. They're already pre-made and you shoot them in. And in hindsight, you look at that and it's patently absurd. These are gene therapy-based technologies, and they should have had the specialty group from gene therapy regulation in addition to the specialty group from vaccine regulation looking at all this stuff. But they didn't.